We stopped at a convenience store outside L.A., and I excused myself to the men's room after buying a road map and a Sharpie marker. In the bathroom sink, I drew the appropriate symbols on the map and then burned it while incanting a spell of entreatment to Iaxiac, the god of lost travelers and forgotten roads. It was some road magic I had picked up off the mad scrawlings on a truck stop bathroom stall outside of Hartford. The scribbling in black marker raved about the glory and the horror of a place called Metropolis Utopia that I never ever wanted to visit. The spell should cover my tracks pretty well if anyone tried to scry where I had been in the last day or so. It also cost me a single memory. Don't ask me which one. The gas station attendant bitched at me for the smell when I walked out of the smoking bathroom a little dazed.
"You're gonna set off the sprinklers, you stupid son of a bitch," he bellowed.
I had the presence of mind to flip him off, I think, still in the fog of the god's kiss. Santos dropped me off at the LAX main terminal. I handed him the last of the money in my wallet, a few hundreds and some twenties. He handed me 100 back.
"Nah, man, you keep it," he said. "From what I've seen, you're going to need it."
"Thanks." "You ever need any help, you ask around. I owe you. You're a good guy," I said. Santos waved. My cell began to chirp.
"I may need you to explain all this to my wife. You got my number. You need a ride, shout."
He drove away and I answered the call.
"Please tell me you are long gone."
It was Dragon. "I'm at LAX," I said, meeting Grinner.
"Listen, you need to get out of town right now," she said. "Vermaven has sent out a pronouncement, not just to LA, to Nightwise globally. She's put you on the Lib Mall. You're number one. Congratulations."
The Lib Mall was the Libro de Araspicum Malum, the Nightwise's most wanted list of scary monsters and super creeps. "For fucking what?" I asked.
"The murder of Roland Blue. For summoning a nightmare turpa that killed a lot of other people before it lost interest and faded. And for all 9 of the unsolved ritual murders dating back to 1984. Apparently, she got intel that you and Blue were running some kind of grotto snuff porn cult together, and he was your accomplice until you killed him last night."
"That's bullshit, and you know it." I was lighting a cigarette and looking around for Grinner's rental car. LAX was a small city all its own, but Grinner had told me the general section of the vast parking moat that he'd be in. "I'll talk to Gita, and we'll—"
"Latham,"
Dragon interrupted.
"There is no negotiation about this. You're wanted, dead or alive. Any owl that spots you is going to drop you."
"They can try," I said, getting a little pissed. "I can handle them."
"Not all of us. Not me," she said, sounding almost panicked. "Damn it, why couldn't you just leave like she asked you to?"
"Because I wasn't fucking done yet," I said. "I found Crystal. She's alive and okay. Case closed. I'm close to having the real identity of the Doug Picault's leadership."
"You're close to getting busted, killed, or banished," she said. "I know you think you're the baddest ass on the block, but the Nightwise is all the baddest asses together. You can't fight that, Latham, and if you try, they will most likely kill you. Please, run, now, until I can talk to the Maven and get this all sorted out."
I spotted Grinner's rental, a white Toyota Camry, with the burly hacker squeezed into it behind the wheel. I headed toward the car. "I'll make sure I email Gita whatever I find before I take them down, Lauren," I said. "You guys can take all the fucking credit. I just want them shut down for good."
"You're not fucking listening to me," she said. Her voice was changing, deepening. She was losing control of her human form. "If I see you, I have to take you down, you understand that? It's my job, it's who I am. It's who you used to be, Latham. Let me bring you in, I can make sure you stay alive."
"You think I did it, don't you?" I said.
"No, of course not. But it's a tight frame," Dragon said, regaining some composure. "Whoever set this up knows you. Played to your reputation. I'm the only one who stood by you last time when at least part of the shit you were accused of was true, jackass. Don't you dare accuse me of selling you out. You have every cop in the life coming down on you now, not to mention the janissaries that will come after you for the bounty."
"Bounty hunters too, huh?" I said. "How much they put on me?"
"Do not fuck around with this, Latham. They are coming for you. All of them are coming for you. Please give yourself up and let me...
I'm not turning myself into you, to anyone. I'm closing these assholes down.
I hung up on her. Fuck. All the night wise everywhere. There wasn't anywhere in this world or several others I could hide for long.
I had to clear this up or I would be a dead man. I opened the door to the car and slid into the passenger seat. Grinner looked like 300 pounds of sausage stuffed into a 200-pound casing. I laughed. I couldn't help it.
"Where's your Fez and the other 6 Shriners?" I said, shutting the door.
"Ha, fucking ha," he said. "I didn't care about anything. Color, style, nothing," I said. "Just give me some leg room. I'm a fluffy motherfucker. Just give me leg room."
He gestured to the cramped compartment trying to eat him.
"I get this."
"Wait till you see your airplane seat," I said. Grinner grunted at me and opened a very thin laptop. He tapped a few keys and then leaned over toward me with it. The screen showed an international bank's logo and columns of figures and dates.
"Hacked a few accounting firms and a bank or 12. I followed the money, and as usual, it did not disappoint. Brett Glide's company, Red Hat Productions, gets regular infusions of cash from a series of dummies and fronts that lead back to..."
"The Legion of Doom?" I offered. Grinner ignored me.
"Pentacle Studios," he said. "The Pentacle Studios. Been around since the silent movie days. They fucking built L.A. around them. Pentacle's a media monster."
"Can you give me a specific person or department at Pentacle that is propping up Glide's business?"
"Yeah," Grinner said. "Better than that, and oh. Brett's name's not really Glide. It's Winder. Brett Winder."
"Winder?" I said. "That name sounds familiar."
"It should."
Grinner opened a second window on the screen. It showed a Forbes article with a picture of an athletic, smiling older man, perhaps in his late 50s. He had a full mane of silver hair and a neatly trimmed goatee. His eyes were an intense, deep brown in the photo. He reminded me of someone I had seen recently, but I couldn't place it. The title of the article was "Winder's World, Pentacle CEO Brings Hollywood into the 21st Century."
"Our boy Brett's old man is Maximilian Winder, the president and CEO of Pentacle Studios. He's the source of the off-the-books cash to Red Hat, along with about a dozen other adult entertainment companies all tucked away under one of their subsidiaries' independent development budgets."
"I wonder if Disney invests in porn companies on the DL, too," I said.
"Ask fucking Hannah Montana. All of the adult entertainment companies Pentacle is secretly funding have one investor in common. Brett Glide."
"So a studio exec is funding his kids walk on the wild side?"
"His adopted kid,"
Grinner added.
"Brett was adopted by Max Winder in 1984. When Brett was 5 years old and Max was only in his 20s. Want to guess which adoption agency Winder used?"
"Son of a bitch," I said. "If Brett was a kid in 1984, he wasn't involved in the initial ritual murders. That had to be Max."
"Yeah, it took some doing. But I found some indications that Winder was involved very covertly with the porn industry in the late 70s and early 80s. He may have produced some films back then, had a few ties to the mob. They were big into porno production back then. Almost all of this is pre-computer era stuff, so it's hard as hell to find anything solid. Hollywood gossip, rumors, scraps. I sifted and didn't come up with enough for anything but a guess. L.A.'s porn scene was the Wild West back then, man. Winder was a ghost in it."
"So Max is the big kahuna of the Dugpa cult, and he raised his boy Brett in the faith."
"Yeah. After Max got all legit and respectable, he'd be too high profile to rub elbows with the money shot crowd," Grinner said. "But his son, raised off the grid at various private schools, he could come back with a new identity and slip right in. I've found payments to 7 out of the 9 victims from Red Hat, all paid out the money from Pentacle. I think we found your cult and your cult leader, Bubba.
Keep the old slaughterhouse going, I said. How insulated is he? How connected? The Illuminati? The Benefactors? The Glass Gallery? God help me, the Fae?
Grinner shook his head. Nope. He's non-existent in the life. No connections, no patrons or debts. Same with Brett. Looks like Roland Blue was their only exposure there.
Good, I said. I rubbed my face, felt the stubble of a beard. I wanted a drink. I wanted several. But with the night was on my ass and the dug put a hunt, I couldn't afford to fuck this up. I still wanted that drink bad. I thought of Cairn tossing away that cigarette, and it gave me a few breaths of reprieve from the screaming ache in my mind. I told Grinner about my phone call with Dragon, that I was now wanted for Roland's murder.
No fucking way,
he said, his massive fist striking the steering wheel. He hit it a few more times for good measure.
What is wrong with these fucking people? We got to get the hell out of here now.
He closed the laptop.
I can get you a package, full identity, in less than an hour. That will buy you enough time to get out to bumfuck Egypt. Make it a little harder to track you.
I'm not going, not just yet, I said.
Ballard, this is as bad as it gets, he said. They will roast your ass if you look at them funny. The Nightwise make the LAPD look like the ACLU.
Yeah, I know, I said. I need to square up with Anku, and I need to make sure these Dugpa bastards go down hard.
No way in hell I'm taking off and leaving you behind. What's the plan?
The plan is you get on your fucking plane and go back to your family, I said. Don't fucking argue with me. You know what Christine would do to me if anything happened to you?
I've already seen this movie, Grinner said. You piss off everyone that gives a shit about you, and they leave, and you go do your lone gunslinger bit. Well, here's a newsflash, desperado. You ain't getting any younger. The Nightwise, they're as sneaky as you, as skilled as you, younger and leaner and more full of piss and vinegar than you are, and they will kill you. And that will be the end of the legend of Latham Ballard, capiche?
Not a bad way to go out, I said, as far as legends go. But I'm in no hurry to check out. I just need to close some deals and get the Nightwise off my ass.
Grinner checked his smartwatch.
I got a little under an hour till flight time. You sure you don't want me to stay, man?
That baby is making you soft, I said.
Fuck you,
he grunted back.
Yeah, you get all that foul language out before you get home, Daddy, I said. I need you to do a few things for me, but it shouldn't be anything you can't do and still make your plane.
I told Grinner what I needed, and he did it. We said goodbye, and he shuffled off toward the terminal, and I caught a cab out to Anku's mansion in Beverly Park. Two of Vigil's security detail met me at the gate when I buzzed to be let in, and they drove me up the hill to the house.
Lucy, I'm home! I called out in my most devastating Ricky Ricardo, my voice echoing off the Venetian tile.
I walked into the huge foyer, fumbling in my jeans pocket for a cigarette and my Zippo. I heard the doors click behind me. Locked. I heard the sound of oiled steel, bolts and slides snicking into place all around me, above me. There were about a dozen security men in the foyer and on the balcony to the second floor above, all pointing guns at me. I hadn't had a shiver in my chakras, hadn't sensed the masking enchantments until now, until it was too late. Lord Theodore Anku stood before me, and I understood why I had sensed nothing. The Fae's magic was most powerful and subtle when it came to spells of misdirection, illusion, and concealment. Vigil stood behind his lord to his left. His face was as unreadable as it had been the first time I met him.
Welcome home, Mr. Ballard, Anku said. You've got some explaining to do.
24. They tied me to a very comfy chair in a conference room in the basement of Anku's mansion. There was no roughing me up, no threats. Very polite, just lots of guns aimed at me in between the pleases and thank yous. It was the classiest I had ever gotten jumped. Anku dismissed the majority of his boys, leaving us with a cozy corps of five of his men, all heavily armed. Sir Vigil, the Fey Lord himself, and me, the center of attention.
"Those ropes, Mr. Ballard, are woven from the silk of goblin spiders from my homeland. They tangle any magic you may attempt to weave, and they glow emerald as they hinder your workings, giving my men more than enough time to put a rune bullet in your brain."
"It's very thoughtful of you to tell me that," I said. "Thanks for the heads up. I assume this little rope party means you have no intention of honoring your word to me."
"Oh, Mr. Ballard," Anku said as he sat in a high-backed conference chair only a few feet from me. "My word is for those worthy of it. You are not. Your breeding, your race, your reputation all preclude you from worth. You are a knave, Mr. Ballard, a necessary evil that people of my station must traffic with from time to time, a means to an end, a tool, a rather blunt but effective tool."
"Not gonna lie, I kind of feel like a tool right now," I said, testing the silk ropes holding my forearms to the arms of the chair. "Tell me, Theo, did you ever even consider playing straight with me in this? Getting Tori out of her service, letting your daughter live in peace?"
"Did I consider if the amount of political capital I would have to invest to free the Lady Selene, your Tori, from her service was worth your efforts for me? No, never. Your Tori is a shade, a puny human soul granted the glory and the privilege to serve the Fae. She too is a tool, Mr. Ballard. She serves her purpose where she is. Your nostalgic love for the memory of a rotting piece of meat in the earth made you agree to a deal your instincts told you was not to your benefit, as did your somewhat narcissistic feeling of connection to my whore of a daughter. Your selfishness, your desire to cling to something that had its time in the light and was gone, made your Tory into a slave, Mr. Ballard. You bargained with my people to keep her soul, to give her a life of a sort, instead of letting her depart for whatever ineffable halls human shades inhabit. You put her in chains. And this whole misadventure was predicated on the glimmer of a hope that you could free her from that existence, could be the hero of the peace. You can't free her. You can't bring her back. And I think the pragmatic part of you knew that, but you let your sentimentality guide you. It's humorous. You pride yourself, the legendary Latham Ballard, on your toughness, your shrewdness, how life has carved you into something hard, jaded. But I could see the moment we met just how soft you are, and how easy it is to manipulate you. You're too selfish to be the hero, and too sentimental to be the villain. You are truly one of the most pathetic creatures I have ever laid eyes upon. I pity you."
"I'll take the pity," I said. "I'll belly crawl out of here."
"A flippant word to parry the truth," he said. "You are as constant, as predictable as the tides, Mr. Ballard. You can go on your way. I will even pay you handsomely for your time. All I need is Cairn's location, if you please."
"No," I said. "Your word may not be worth spit, but mine is." I looked over to Vigil. His eyes slid away from my accusing gaze. "You tried to fuck your own daughter, you sick son of a bitch. Use her like a breeding machine to keep your perverted bloodline pure. That's some real hillbilly shit right there, Theo. Your wife would curse your name, but thankfully for her she's gone already, gone for good." Anku's human guise shredded as he stood, like a sheet ripped from a clothesline in an angry wind. His totality was too much for my human mind to hold. "You Fey don't carry on after death, do you?" I said. "You just evaporate like dew, like she did.
You're both lucky she didn't live long enough to know what you were capable of, eh, Theo?
Ankhu struck my face with the back of his hand, and I felt my skin numb as the force of it snapped my head to the side. When I opened my eyes, he was flesh and blood again. I could feel my eyes swelling shut. The flesh on the right side of my face was too tight pain paper. My head rang from what I suspected was a minor concussion.
"Well now," I said, spitting out a mouthful of blood. "Look who decided to act like an ape. I know the score on you too, Theo. The only things you give a shit about in this world are your family's reputation and your dead wife. Didn't take much to push your buttons and use you either, did it, Lord Ankhu?"
Ankhu sat back down. He withdrew a silk handkerchief and dabbed his glistening forehead. "What a vicious little mammal you are," he said, dabbing his upper lip and replacing the hanky. "I almost wish I could keep you as a pet. I have made a study of your race, and I have to say, Mr. Ballard, you are a shining example of raw, unpretentious humanity. You should be in some gallery somewhere, perhaps a zoo."
"Last chance, asshole," I said. "Cut me loose."
"Or what, pray tell?"
Ankhu asked, leaning forward in his chair.
"You think your little display of common hustling there puts you in a position to demand anything?"
"No," I said, "this does. I figured you'd try to track and trace my activity through that expensive secure cell phone you gave me. I was sure of it when Vigil found me the night I got a hold of Louise DeMere at the MS-13 crib. I knew if I ditched it, you'd know I was on to you and find some other way to track me. So I had my hacker jailbreak it for me, so it was giving you false information on where I was and who I was calling."
Ankhu glanced at Vigil, giving the knight a sour look. I kept going.
"From there he was able to trace it back to your servers, use the phone's connection to hack you."
Ankhu gestured to one of his men to bring him something. The man pulled a plastic Ziploc freezer bag from under his coat.
"So he now has access to your business, to everything. I figure the guys who sent that Carnifex to dust me, House Xana, right, they'd love to get their hands on your books. So if I don't send him word by a specific time that I'm free and clear, he pushes a button and you lose everything you still give a shit about."
Ankhu nodded. He looked more amused than anything. "Well then," he said, tossing the baggie into my lap, "I suppose it was fortuitous of me to see that your man couldn't push that button." The plastic was smeared with fresh blood, still warm. Inside the bag were 8 fingers and 2 thumbs. I felt dizzy nausea swirl up in me, snowballing into panic. "Your Mr. Shelton, your Grinner, as his vulgar argo proclaims him, he never made his plane." The fear was thick in my mouth, fighting with rage, trying to catch and burn. "You fucking piece of shit, you're dead." I glared at Vigil, and his face was a screen of static.
"Your bitch Vigil there, he pointed him out to you?"
"Quite so," Ankhu said, looking to Vigil and nodding. "Mr. Shelton has been quite resistant to divulging information. I had thought it best to use him as leverage to get you to tell me where Cairn is, but Sir Burris assured me that you would not be moved by such threats. He said Shelton was merely a retainer of yours, a mercenary, and that you care only for yourself. I made Shelton a very generous offer to betray you. He declined. I repeated the offer after each snip. He refused until he lost consciousness from blood loss and shock. Unfortunate, but I thought this demonstration would clarify your situation for you, Mr. Ballard. I am not some common street hustler you are used to outwitting, some stolid mage you can bedazzle with your criminal acumen. Our kind was old when your world was a cooling pebble. In every possible way, I am a god compared to you. You honestly think you will win here, that you will taste victory?" He took the fingers out of my lap and held them before my face. "You will not. However, there may be an opportunity remaining for you to survive this.
Fuck you,
I said as I spat at him. Fear had turned my mouth into a desert. Anku laughed as he tossed Grinner's digits on the conference room table. It was one of the most horrible sounds I have ever heard. God laughing at your suffering, your fear, knowing how alone in this you really are. My heart was trying to tear itself out of my chest, and acid was scratching my mouth and throat. I thought I might piss myself. This was real. This was it. Gun to my head, no way to bullshit my way out, no way to fight my way out. This was it.
A valiant response, he said. The hero ascendant. I think it's time I introduced you to yourself, Mr. Ballard. It's a gift long overdue.
He turned to one of his men.
The manticore venom, Jamie.
The soldier picked up a red and white igloo cooler and placed it in Anku's slender hands.
I hope you appreciate, Mr. Ballard, the courtesy I give you in not resorting to torture. Your reputation preceded you, and I know you have been interrogated by some of the best in the world, in and out of the life, and that your fortitude is legendary. Also, torture is notoriously unreliable in extracting information.
He swiveled open the cooler and removed a hypodermic needle. It was filled with an algae-green substance.
This, he said, holding up the needle and tapping it lightly, is the venom of a manticore, a creature of the first world, the land of fairy. It cost the lives of a dozen of my knights to obtain this. The venom will quickly and effectively burn out the majority of your nervous system. It will render you forever unable to work magic, locking away those miraculous places in you from access. Your light will be hidden under the bushel, Mr. Ballard, for the rest of your life. It will also, I'm afraid, reduce your cognitive and motor abilities significantly. No more witty quips. No more, how do you say, snappy patter. You will be a shambling, twitching husk of a man. I also intend to make sure you are well and truly addicted to my finest, purest heroin before we release you into the wilds of this fine city. I will not kill you, Mr. Ballard. To do so would be to give you an escape. Humans like you often long for death as much as you fear it. Again, pathetic. No, if you do not tell me where Ken is, this is what will happen.
Anku turned to address Vagil.
Boris, go to Mr. Shelton and await my word. If Mr. Ballard gives me the information I require, I want you to kill Mr. Shelton, do you understand?
What? Vagil said, genuine confusion and disgust crossing his face.
You heard me. If Mr. Ballard refuses to give me Cairn's location, then take his associate to a hospital, and perhaps they can still save his dwindling life.
Lord Anku,
Vagil began. Anku shut him down.
You have your orders, knight. Go.
Vagil walked to the conference room door, opened it. He looked back to me. Burris and I held each other's gaze for a heartbeat. Then he walked out, closing the door behind him. My mind was dumb with fear. It swallowed my anger, swallowed everything.
So the stage is set, Anku said, pushing up the sleeve of my T-shirt. Keep the gun to his head, please. Time to look in a mirror, Mr. Ballard. The hero here, would keep his mouth shut, not give me the morsel of information I require. He would save the whore he sees as a fair maiden, save his loyal manservant who refused to betray him even as he was maimed, and sacrifice himself for the good of others. But the villain, the true villain would never have gotten himself here in the first place. He would have done his job and been on his way, richer for his treachery. But you, Mr. Ballard, you, as a bumbling villain, have a choice now to salvage this mess you have created for yourself.
Tell me where
my daughter is. Tell me, and I will release you, unmolested, and let you go on your way in the world, free to make up any lie you need to tell yourself and the world to preserve the illusion that somewhere in you is a good man.
He raised the needle, brought it toward my arm.
What will it be?
No one was coming. I had worked hard for a long time to make sure everyone knew I didn't need them, and now, at the end of it, I was going out alone. Ankou's face was close to mine. He was smug and in control. He knew me. He knew the real me, and he loved the terror, the indecision in my eyes, like a trapped animal. The needle came closer, its cold steel touching my skin. Ankou's thumb was poised to push the plunger once the needle was in. I was going to lose me, lose all the parts of me I was proudest of, the things that mattered most, that made me special. Without them, I would be nothing, no one. I could imagine the pity on my friends' faces. I would exist at the kindness of others, and this world, even at its best, was far from kind. And to have my story end this way? In a fight, in a blaze of glory, maybe, but not strapped to a chair, not a meaningless, common death, not me, never for me. I closed my eyes. I began to feel the needle rip into my skin. 1 second, one solitary second. It was the longest of my life. "Stop," I said. The needle was taken away from my arm. I opened my eyes and looked into the prisms of Ankou's. I told him. I gave him Karen's address. He nodded. The arrogance slipped from his face like tension leaving, like he was forgiven a pet that shit on the rug. "Now you understand," he said. "You know who you are now, don't you, Mr. Ballard?" I began to answer him, answer myself, when the door exploded. Vigil, wounded, bleeding, pistols blasting, dove into the room. He shot one of Ankou's other knights, a bloom of red spreading across the man's chest as he fell and died. The other three were firing back almost at once. One of them pulled Ankou away from me and headed toward the back of the room. Vigil took a bullet to the side of the chest as he tumbled into the middle of the knights, each trained as he had been, each equally as deadly. He drove a pistol's barrel into one of the men's faces with a crunch and pulled the trigger. Burris fired at another of the shooters with his other gun, but the knight grabbed Vigil's arm and jerked the gun to the side as it fired, blowing a big hole in the conference room wall. Vigil pivoted, bent his arm in and down, and shot the guy grappling with him in the side of the face. The third man, still standing, jammed his pistol low into Vigil's gut and fired. The gunshot tore a hole clean through him, staggering Burris backward. Vigil returned fire as he fell against the wall and slid down onto his ass, winging his shooter in the shoulder. Two of the men were still up, staggered and bleeding. Ankou's bodyguard rushed the fey noble out of the conference room, shouting for backup down the hall. Ankou looked back at me, a strange look of serenity still on his face. Then he was out of sight. I opened the furnace of my Manipura chakra, stoked it with unbearable guilt and rage, and let it vomit out of me with almost no focus. The enchanted ropes flared green a second before they became ash. I stood as the guard Vigil had shot in the side of the face turned to shoot me. He turned to ash, too, as did part of the conference table and the wall behind him. The last knight standing with a bleeding shoulder had me dead bang. He raised his gun, began to squeeze the trigger. The message to pull the trigger never made it to his finger as his brain exploded. Vigil tracked the headless body with his smoking gun until it thudded onto the floor. Then he slumped, his eyes closing. I knelt by him, slapping his face. "Come on, come on! We gotta go before the rest—"
"No others,"
Vigil said.
"I took care of them. All of them. Grinner's alive. Down the hall. He's in bad shape, but he's—"
He drifted off.
"Come on, God damn it! Hang on! You're supposed to be a badass knight!"
Vigil's lips opened even though his eyes didn't.
"Not anymore. burned it all down, not anymore.
He went silent. I found a working cell phone in the carnage and called Anna. Get over here, I said when she answered. I gave her the mansion's address. Vigil and Grinner are down. It should be safe here, but get a hold of Duane and have him meet you here. Call ambulances, call cops, hurry! Latham, are you okay? You sound... I hung up. I grabbed a few things from the room and sprinted back toward the garage on the upper level. I took the first car I could find. I don't remember what it was. It didn't matter. I noticed the limo that had been in the garage was gone. I cursed as I roared down the drive through the already open gate and onto the freeway. I did over 100 the whole way to Encinitas, to Cairn's door. I wished I knew the secrets of the road magic that let Viomancers bend space, but I didn't. And even if I did, I don't think I had the focus, the calm to do any working that required clear thought. My mind was a wildfire. There was no reason in it, no plan, just the highway and the sick guilt and dread eating the core of me. I screeched to a stop at Cairn Ankou's house, sprinted up the sidewalk and through the shattered remains of the front door. There was the smell of gunpowder and ozone, the jagged afterimage of sudden violence humming in the now still, silent air. Cairn's body was in the hallway, near the shelf of family photos. Her new family, her only real family. She was splayed on her stomach, like she had been running down the hall when they got her. She had been shot in the back several times. I dropped down beside her, no strength left in my legs. Felt her warm blood pooling around her. Her eyes looked up at me, empty. No accusations, no fear, nothing. I closed them. She was clutching one of the photos of her, Joey, and Garland, like a drowning woman might clutch at a life preserver. It was the same photo she had shown me, her favorite one. As I sat next to her, I saw that she had been shot several times in the belly by someone at point-blank range. There were wounds on her hand that made me think she had tried with her last breath to protect the child in her stomach. She was dead. The baby was dead, and I was still living. I wanted to cry, to scream, to tear at my own face and skin, but I had no fucking right to any of it. I didn't even think I was capable of crying anymore. She was beautiful even now. Crystal Myth. Cairn Ankou. Mother. Wife. Daughter. I searched the house. There were no other bodies, no loving husband, no little, now motherless boy. There were no signs of a struggle, only a brutish, hasty search. One of the family pictures from the wall in the hallway was missing. The purple crystal bracelet was still around Cairn's wrist. I took it off and put it in my pocket. I took the photo she was clutching, too. I held her still warm hand for a moment. I walked out of the house, vaguely aware of the neighbors gawking and pointing, some snapping pictures with cell phone cameras. Sirens threatened off in the distance. I got in the car and I drove away. 25. The executive offices of Pentacle Studios were off Santa Monica Boulevard. Their security was good, even a few tricks and traps for those in the life. I bypassed most of it with a lifetime worth of skills cultivated toward getting into and out of locked places. The Harryhausen Animates, the IMAX Tesseract, and the Trebek Sphinx proved a little more time-intensive, but I was very focused on getting my face time with the CEO. I burst into a conference room full of Pentacle execs, yes-man, pitch-man, money guys, and gophers. At the head of the table, looking like a dark, slumming Borgia king, sat Max Winder in a wine-colored button-up with no tie and a black Isabel Marant blazer. His long white hair and goatee were perfect, flawless.
"Hi," I said. "Sorry I'm late. I'm the asshole you've been trying to kill for a while."
Everyone in the room shut up. They all looked to Winder, whose face remained serene, save for an arched eyebrow.
"Ah, Latham," Winder said, standing. He was a few inches taller than me, and I sensed no tension or menace in him whatsoever. He strode to me and extended a hand for me to shake. I declined. I didn't know that our meeting was today, but no worries. Please have a seat. Espresso? Cliff Bar? Bottled water? Winder's executive secretary rushed into the room, breathless.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Winder. He just ran right past me. He came out of the executive elevator somehow. I'll call security.
They might take a while to answer, I chimed in. That won't be necessary, Glennis, Winder said. If you could please make that other call for me and tell our friend that Mr. Ballard is here now for our appointment. Glennis looked at me like I was contagious and then nodded to her boss.
Of course, sir.
She closed the door behind her. Winder returned to his chair at the head of the table. I remained standing, the door to my back. I know what brings you here, Latham, he said. You don't have to worry about talking out of school. Everyone here is on the same page. We all travel in the same social circle, or summoning circle, if you prefer. Laughter came from all corners of the room. Makes sense, I said. Why meet in some dingy cave when you can have your human sacrifices catered? Blunt, but essentially accurate, Winder said. We're a Los Angeles tradition, Latham. We've been here since the beginning, through the good times and the bad. We're bankers and politicians, dream makers and working stiffs, the homeless and the 1%. We cross all the lines, all the barriers. We are explorers in sensation. We breathe in the universe, and it breathes us in. You're murderers and molesters, I said, walking around the table looking from face to face. Some amused, others guarded, most of them bland. You destroy lives and you poison souls. There's nothing noble in what you do, nothing enlightening. You're self-centered bastards who muck in people's lives and don't give a damn about the consequences. Sound familiar to you at all? Winder asked. Like you, Latham, we take the universe as it is, not as we wish it to be. We use whatever works. We know the only sin is to miss out on something, some scrap of experience. Can you honestly say you're any different than us? You corrupt souls, and then you devour them, I said. You can't justify that. Nor do we see any reason to, Winder said. Latham, my senses are as acute as yours. I see the scars and the stains on your aura. You have done everything you are accusing us of yourself. I paused. I hadn't slept or had a drink in over 2 days. I felt thin and full of holes. Winder's words hit me hard as Anku's accusation. I kept getting locked in rooms full of mirrors and I wished I couldn't see. This world is a moral vacuum, he said, standing again, walking toward me. We, those like you and I, those who follow us, possess the power and the wisdom to move through it like gods. He stood before me, still placid. Who can stand in judgment of gods, Latham? The Nightwise, I said, feeling my resolve return. They can, and they do. They stand between all the sick, twisted, hungry things and the darkness and the Jane Does, the crystal myths of this world, all the connections to the murdered women and you. To your companies and your sick little club, everything that we dug up, I had it all sent electronically to the maven of the Nightwise. They know about all of you now, and they are going to shut your asses down. The door, still to my back, clicked open. I turned to see why Winder was smiling. Gaeta Templeton, the high maven of the Nightwise, returned Windsor's smile.
Hello, Max. Latham,
Gaeta said. She paused to kiss me deeply as she passed me and then took an unclaimed seat at the conference table beside Winder's.
I hope he hasn't been too disruptive, Max, she said. He's good at making messes. I know. I've had to clean up enough of them.
Max patted me on the shoulder and then crossed to give Gaeta a peck on the cheek before she sat down.
Not at all. We've been having a nice chat. Can I get you anything, my dear?
"Tea, please," she said.
One of the hangers-on in the room fetched Gita a hot cup and saucer. She regarded me.
"Bewilderment does not suit you well, Latham," she said. "The unflappable detective struck mute. No witty quip. No lighting a cigarette with an accusing aha."
Another flutter of laughter from the room.
"How long?"
I said to Gita. My throat was dry.
"Since before I recruited you, my dear boy,"
Gita said, then sipped her tea and held up the cup.
"A touch more cream, if you please."
The gopher obeyed as Gita continued.
"I met Max back in 1978, was it, Max? We were so young. We crossed swords a few times when I was an investigator in the field. I dealt with some of his early efforts and made it my business to delve deeper into his background. Within a few years, I knew about his father and the cult, and that was when he made me his sales pitch. It was very convincing."
"So you kept the Nightwise away from the Dugpa, from the murders," I said. Gita nodded.
"And from poor Roland Blue," she continued. "He was our weak link, our necessary vulnerability, I'm afraid. Raleigh knew it, though, and he accepted that he might be disposable one day. At least I like to think he understood that."
"He found crystal for us," Winder said as Gita sipped her tea again.
"He and my son, Brett, they recognized how powerful an asset a full-blooded fae would be."
"Asset," I said, shaking my head. "Why don't you just call her what she was to you? I'm a cod pa, an offering, a sacrifice."
"The strongest we'd ever hoped to have," Winder said, "even greater than the high workings my father orchestrated for the group in the late 60s.
"Your father," I said.
"Yes," Winder said. "You met him at Corcoran, at the prison."
"Manson," I said. "Your father is Charles Manson."
"Yes," Winder said. "The group, they called themselves the Process Church back then. They hid me away in the early 60s. I was a macabre pa in a sense myself. I was given to the group by my father, raised in wealth, power, and privilege, among other members, given a bulletproof name, the keys to the Hollywood kingdom, taught the true nature of reality, the jagged path to enlightenment. I was raised just as I have raised Brett."
"So helter-skelter, those murders were more sacrifices for you bastards," I said.
"Yes," Winder said with a chuckle. "The group has always had so many agents, knowing and unknowing, in Hollywood. We control this city and all the power within it. My father may be a coarse man, like you, Latham, but in his own way he is a savant, just as you are." "Which brings us full circle," Gita said. "You're going to try to kill me," I said, "as a reminder of what happens when someone meddles in your business." "Furthest thing from it," Winder said. "We want you to join us."
"Are you kidding me?" I said.
"Latham, I didn't recruit you for the Nightwise," Gita said. "I recruited you for us, for the group. You'd be perfect." "Why do you think you're still alive?"
Winder said. "We had opportunities to kill you back in the 80s when you began poking around in the sacrifices.
Gita said you were worth salvaging and found other ways to keep you off our trail." I looked at Gita's painfully sky-blue eyes, as guiltless as infancy.
"You. You're the one who set the frame on me back then. You set me up."
"Don't be so melodramatic," she said. "You were in descent after Nico died. You were on your way to being a dirty cop. I just moved that process along a bit."
"Did you have Nico killed when he wouldn't drop looking into the killings, too?" I asked. Gita pursed her lips and sighed. She ran a hand through her fine silver hair.
"Yes, I tried to aim him toward the same path you were staggering down, avoid anything so messy and sad, but he wouldn't have it, and he began to suspect me, so I had Roland kill him."
The only reason we tried to eliminate you at Roland Blow's club, Winder said, was we couldn't be certain if you'd accept our offer, and we couldn't allow you to compromise the integrity of the group. When you blackmailed Roland, we had to do something to shut him up. You would have just been collateral damage in that. You understand, Latham. How many times have you thrown someone under the bus to serve your own interest? It was nothing personal. Crash Cart is an excellent tool, but I'm afraid he gets a bit too exuberant in his work.
Manson, your dad, he taught you how to dredge that thing up, didn't he? I said, walking to the wall-length window that gave an inspiring view of the studio grounds and past that the city. From up here, everything looked clean and ordered. It was a great special effect. Winder smiled.
Yes, he said. And I taught Brett. My father was unable to be very present in my life for reasons both practical and psychological, but he did his best to impart to me his truths, and I have found him to be very wise. In a different age, a different world, he would be an oracle, a sage, a wisdom like you and your grandmother.
I turned from the window, and it began to crack, a wide radial spiderweb with me at its center. The room dropped several degrees, and many of the faithful suddenly looked less smug, more frightened.
You, I said, never mention her again. She's too good for your toilet of a mind, your filthy fucking tongue, to ever even acknowledge her existence. I will turn you inside out and keep you awake while I do it.
Winder's smile never left his lips. Of course, my apologies. I know how sensitive that subject is for you. We cultivate our children, show them the wisdom we have culled from our experience, and set their feet upon the path. They are the future, our future. While it is regrettable that Crystal's father caught up to her before we could, her child will find sanctuary with us.
What did you say? I asked, narrowing my gaze at Winder.
Max, you think Latham and I could have a moment alone?
Gita asked.
Of course, Winder said. Let's take five, everyone. Give our new potential recruit a few moments to process all this.
The conference room began to clear. There were murmurs of normal water cooler conversations. The game last night, the big joke on the latest sitcom, plans for the weekend. Not the kind of things you'd ever expect soul-corrupting and ritual-sacrificing dark tantric sorcerers to discuss.
Winder was the last out to ensure the room cleared fully. He put a hand on my shoulder and spoke to me as earnestly as a preacher at a funeral. Think about our offer, Latham, please. We can give you a place to belong. We can be your family.
He nodded to Gita and then ambled out of the conference room door and shut it behind him.
He's right, Gita said, about everything. You'd be so good here with us. We'd be so good together again.
Were you ever really what you pretended to be? I asked as she pulled me close to her. She had the faintest scent of Clive Christian number one and alcohol. Her hair smelled of wind shivering through wildflowers. Her voice was intimate, close to my skin.
Were you? She said. All that talk of nobility, agonizing over honor and duty. I tried to show you when you came to my office. We are animals, Latham, delusional animals. We stumble between what we believe is right and wrong, and then try to justify our every action to ourselves, to some fairy tale god, to each other. That is an exhausting way to live. It wore me out.
She brushed my fallen hair out of my eyes.
I know it wears you out, too.
Her lips pressed gently to my throat. I was back in that conference room, that frozen moment with the metal stinger of the syringe to my flesh, the wildfire panic, the scramble to survive. Undamaged, no matter the cost. Anku's words, now Gita's words. What happens if I refuse? I said, stepping back from her. It was harder to do than it should have been. Gita sighed.
You'd be committing suicide, she said. The Nightwise will hunt you down wherever you go. No one will believe you if you try to tell them about me. Your reputation is less than dirt. Mine is immaculate. Best case scenario, they capture you, convict you of our crimes, and send you into the Hollow Lands. You'll never see Earth or another living soul again. Since I know you, I'm fairly certain you'd go down fighting before you'd let the Order banish you from Earth. Either way, you die.
Can you give me some time to think about it? I asked.
No,
she said.
You walk out that door without committing to us. Then you are going to die, Latham. No threat, no hyperbole, just a fact. For once in your life, do the right thing.
What makes you so sure that Crystal had a child?
Our people got onto the crime scene, she said. I saw the photos on the wall. Yours, too, from the neighbors' cameras. Don't worry, I swept up after you with the regular cops, had the Amber Alerts and the bolos canceled. We gathered the little boy's hair, a few other sympathetic items. We'll track him soon, bring him into the fold.
What about his father? I asked. Gita gave me a pissed-off look.
Don't insult me with that question, and I won't insult you with my answer. The boy's father is nothing exceptional, one of Roland's old goons. We have no need for him. The official version will be that he killed Crystal in a tawdry and common domestic dispute and was brought to justice, dead or alive. The poor little boy will be placed in a good home. One of ours.
Gita looked at me, and I saw an idea blossom behind those beautiful eyes.
You could be his father, Latham. Raise the boy. Convince yourself you're keeping him safe from our evil influence, if that makes you feel better. When he's old enough, he will rise and destroy his grandfather, claim the House of Anku for his own. For us, you can be by his side, his wisdom, his protector, his voice of compassion. You can make sure he doesn't grow up without a father like you did.
I didn't know what to say. My words, my thoughts were breaking into one another, tumbling like icebergs crashing. I had no instruments, no radar. I acted, not thinking. I was good at that. I walked to the door and looked back at Gita one last time. "Pull the trigger," I said. "I'm taking as many of you with me as I can."
So, a glorious death going down swinging against the assembled Nightwise, she said. That is a fitting method of suicide for Latham Ballard.
Death by cop? Something like that, yeah, I said. I began to open the door.
We had a child,
she said.
You and I.
I stopped, looked back to her again.
I found out after you left L.A., left the Nightwise. She's powerful, Latham, like you, like me. Maybe even stronger than both of us together. She's your blood. You could still meet her, still be part of her life, if you join us.
She'd better off without me, I said, and walked out the door.
There's always a drink when you need one, some dark dive or pub, a mom-and-pop corner watering hole, or an expensive club where the drunks hide behind craft beers and expensive wine. You've got the brightly colored chain restaurants with their island bars when you can watch the drunk in a facsimile of his native environment while you enjoy your potato skins and sliders. There's liquor stores where the faithful pull up 20 minutes before the place opens and grab their bottle while still in sweatpants and a robe. Hotel and airport bars where lost, wandering souls gather trying to pantomime at real life or soothe the ache of being away from home. Bowling alleys with the ubiquitous plastic pitchers and clear disposable cups. Convenience stores and drug stores with yummy bottles of cough medicine. Alleys in your car in a parking lot. The shade of an underpass. Cars roaring above you. The smell of diesel in the dark air. Pick a city, any city, and you'll find yourself a drink. The truth is, for a real Olympic-level drunk, the where is irrelevant. All that matters is the when. I sat on a bar stool and looked at myself in the mirror. My face welled in shadows above the necks of bottles, a city of glass in distilled, annihilated memories. This bar was in an old Chinese restaurant that catered to Hollywood tourists
neighborhood regulars, and a smattering of hipster college kids looking to slum safely. It was all scenery, like on some back lot of a studio. None of it mattered. None of it was real. The bartender was as tired and disinterested in me as I was in him. He paused in his orbit.